This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. If you want to take the pulse of healthcare in this country, Bill Roper is probably one of the first people you want to turn to. He is a doctor trained in pediatric medicine, but he's also spent his career in public roles helping to guide health policy decisions. He's worked in public health in Alabama, headed up the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, eventually led the nation's Medicare and Medicaid programs, and now he is the CEO of UNC's healthcare system, which includes Rex Hospital in Raleigh, and he is the dean of the UNC School of Medicine and joins me in the studio now. Bill Roper, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
All right, so Obamacare, how's it going? Good or bad?
Well, it's a work in progress, shall we say. I don't think they planned for it to start quite like this. Uh-huh. I take your question somewhat seriously, but it was a big effort to do some important things that need to be done. The people who were the architects, not the president himself, but the people around him who crafted what's the Affordable Care Act, most people, including the president, called it Obamacare. They're friends of mine, most of them. And the things that they put together are not outlandish, crazy things. I wouldn't have done it quite the way they did. It was overly regulatory, too much detail, et cetera. But unfortunately, what now most people are hearing and reacting to is this mammoth failure of the website and the rollout and whatever. And I trust that soon that's going to get remedied. I mean, it's a tech problem, and they'll get some tech people to fix it. But there are many, many other aspects of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and that's what I think we all need to pay attention to.
And they're fixing it now. So on the hunch that it won't be long before that's not the problem, what's good about it?
Well, I begin with the fact that up until its passage, we had a vast number of people in America who don't have health insurance. Best at numbers were about 50 million people out of our 310 million folks who live in the country. Notice I say who live in the country, not citizens, mm-hmm. because we have to take account for the fact that there are a large number of people who are not citizens but who do reside here. And we pay a heavy price as a nation for the fact that not everybody has full access to health care in America. I know it's often said, and some of my good friends continue to say it, that we've got the world's finest health care system in America. The facts are just not that way. Yes, we do have places in America that have the very best health care the world can offer, one of which I am privileged to lead. Another is here in Duke University in Durham, and others around the country. But on average, the performance of the American healthcare system is not nearly as good as many other countries have.
Yeah, how do people even say that? The leading health indicators are all low compared to developed countries and at the bottom in every category.
Well, we're not at the bottom, but some people do these international rankings, and the most recent one I've seen says out of the 200 countries in the world, we rank 37th or something like that. And the problem is that the measures that are used, longevity, infant mortality, the cost of care, et cetera, bring all those things together and pose the question, how are we doing on average? And average is just that. It's average. And you can't just look at what happens to the people at the top of society or in the best of institutions. It's what also happens to people at the bottom of society and in the worst of institutions. And on average, we come out pretty average.
Well, and it's some of those indicators at the bottom, again, for life expectancy, infant mortality among developed countries, and then the average kind of brings you up to maybe to the middle of the pack. So why does it matter? I mean, does it really, in terms of public policy, and I don't mean in terms of the health of those individuals who can't access care, but for all of the rest of us, and as a public policy, why should that matter to us that some people don't get health care?
Well, it should matter to all of us, not just because of our compassion for our fellow human being, but that is important. But beyond that, we pay a heavy economic price for our dysfunctional healthcare system. People who do pay through their insurance or out of their own pocketbook for health care, pay more than it costs to deliver their care so that we, UNC Healthcare and others like us, may cross-subsidize and pay for the care of people who have no means of paying. And so those distortions, if I can call it that way, in the way the financing of healthcare work creates a series of problems, most immediately the one that we need to talk about is it places us in a very uncompetitive position internationally. In the global economy that's written about so much these days, American goods and services are much more expensive than those produced in some other nations because the cost of health care is so very high here.
Now, again, we'll sort of emphasize that this is complicated legislation and a complicated set of networks when we talk about health care. Well, what was it that you would have changed? You talked about some of the things that you wouldn't have done in the Affordable Care Act. Yeah. What would you have done differently?
I would have not tried to do everything at once. And again, it's easy to be critical in retrospect. But the law is overly complicated because they took on lots of issues and tried to manage them all at the same time. A second thing I would have done differently is I would have been much more focused on the cost of health care. What the legislation tried to do primarily is cover the uninsured, which is a laudable goal, to be sure. But it basically said, let's cover the uninsured and we'll figure out how to control the cost of care later. But if you stop and think, what that really is saying is we're going to take the world's most expensive healthcare system and make it a whole lot more expensive, and we'll figure out how to deal with that down the road. And I'd have flipped those.
One of the adjustments, of course, along the way was in Medicaid, and one of the compensations was an expansion of Medicaid program for the states. This state rejected that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I've tried to persuade the legislature and the governor to go a different way and to do the expansion of Medicaid. I do understand, because I've met with them many times and talked with them about it, they believed when making the decision that there were so many problems with North Carolina's Medicaid program that they just shouldn't expand it until they got those problems fixed. And that's a rational position. I do understand it. But there is a countervailing argument that says this is an opportunity to do something that will be a benefit not only to the thousands of people who would then be enrolled in Medicaid, but it would assist hospitals and doctors who are providing care for free now. They'd get some payment for it, and it would be an economic boost to our state at a time when we're still struggling to try to get out of the recession that we've been in. I hope that in the subsequent legislative session and beyond, our state's leaders will revisit that issue.
Well, you know, in a way, the state, the legislature and the governor have taken the position that you did just a second ago and saying, hey, wait a minute, you don't want to expand this thing if you're going to keep pushing the costs up. But in your answer just now, you said, well, but the money goes back into the system,
right,
and it pays back those people who are actually not only paying for health care for people who need it, it pays the system that's providing it.
It does. But again, to be fair to my friends in state government, they would say, and I say, that the money is not free money. It is from the federal government, and what it does is add to the deficit, meaning my grandchildren will pay those bills when they come due. So we need to be realistic about this.
When you were young, you benefited greatly from a public system of higher education, certainly in Alabama, and I wonder how that shapes how you see your role at the University of North Carolina, public institution, medical school.
So, yes, I went to public schools, secondary school, public college, and public medical school in Alabama. I very much believe in public education. And the University of North Carolina, the system, which includes the 16 campuses and now two medical schools, we play a very important role in our state, giving opportunity to a wide swath of young people in North Carolina to be educated for whatever their profession or lot in life, and especially to educate the next generation of health professionals. It's something that we take very seriously. The organization that I'm privileged to lead, the med school and the healthcare system, we serve the state, and that's a major part of our makeup, our DNA, as I would put it, is we are here because of the people of North Carolina.
And also have to pay attention to policymakers and politicians in the state of North Carolina as well. So we'll talk about that accountability. We'll talk about tuition and access to public universities and more about the healthcare system in the state of North Carolina as our conversation with Bill Roper continues. Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare System, including Rex Hospital in Raleigh, and the dean at the UNC School of Medicine. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare System, including Rex in Raleigh, and the dean of the UNC School of Medicine. Before the break, we're talking about the value of public institutions like this to prepare future medical staff. But there's a lot of complaint that it's getting too expensive for folks in the state of North Carolina and anywhere.
Well, I think one of the big issues now coming to the fore and will be for some years is higher education is simply too expensive. I would predict that just like a couple of years ago people decided healthcare was too expensive, we're now deciding as a nation that colleges and universities are too expensive. And what we are trying to do at my UNC School of Medicine is re-engineer how we train physicians and others to take cost out of the organization so that we can deliver our product, if I can put it that way, less expensively. We haven't finished that yet. We're actually just at the beginning of it. But it's an important commitment to say we get large-scale support from the people of North Carolina. We need a bit more, but we need to do our part by lowering our expenses.
Well, how would you do that? Well, how would changing training, assuming you don't mean lower the quality?
No, I don't.
But how do you do that to bring down costs? How's that work?
Well, if I can use this as a way of making the point, if I said to you that this radio station needs to figure out how to operate 20% more cost effectively, y'all would probably do some things differently with your electronics and your technology and your people and whatever. Those are the very things that we're talking about. How do we teach? How do we provide classroom content in a way using iPads and iPhones and computers more cost effectively than we used to? Can we do something different with the way we schedule the year and schedule the rotations and so on? Yes, as you said in your setup, we don't want to diminish the quality of our instruction. In fact, we want to do just the opposite. We want to improve it. And we think there are some lessons to be learned from how others have done education reform.
In your resume, of course, there is heading Medicare and Medicaid. And when you include that with VA, it turns out that roughly 50% of America's health care is socialized.
is paid for by us, the government, whatever. Yeah,
sure. It's paid for by the government, and by and large, it works. Would you say there's not a lot of controversy about that? And particularly the VA, which has become a model for at least record keeping in other ways. Why do you suppose there is this resistance, given how much of our medical care is delivered by a single payer, the U.S. government, to a single payer system for the entire program?
I think it begins, but with the deep-seated strain in American culture that Americans are rugged individualists and don't like people telling them what to do. And one the years that I served in the federal government, my wife and son and I had health care through a government program, and my wife bristled at the time that she wanted to go somewhere else rather than the place that they were telling us to go. And it's that same notion that has gotten so many people riled up these days about Obamacare, as we were talking a moment ago, because they believe that somehow their choice is being taken away from them as to their doctor and their health plan and so on. An important point that needs to be made, though, is that wide choice, freedom of choice, if you want to put it that way, is an expensive way of doing things. And we need to make sure that people are conscious of those costs and, to the extent possible and fair, I believe that we should have individuals facing at least a great portion of that cost so that they factor that into their thinking as they pound the table and say, I've got to go to whoever I choose to go to.
Well, one of the things that you said in the run-up to the Affordable Care Act debate was, as President Obama was making his appeal for this legislation, you said the one thing he left out was telling us that we're all going to have to sacrifice. And you pointed to sort of every sector and said, look, this is what's going to have to be done. I'll ask you to repeat some of that now.
Well, for the last several years, I've been given a speech that talks about the myths in Americans' misunderstanding of health care. One myth I've already mentioned, that is we have the world's finest health care system. Another is that everywhere you go, you get high-quality health care. That's just not true. Another myth is that everybody eventually gets all the care they need. Nobody falls through the cracks. Unfortunately, that one's not true either. A fourth myth is that we shouldn't really worry about the cost of care. As I said a moment ago, that's a myth because it puts us at a great disadvantage in international economic competition. But finally, I think the most pernicious myth of all is this one that has been said: if you like your health care the way it is, nothing about it will change. And unfortunately, our president, President Obama, is the one who's been saying that for several years here. And I understand why he said it. That is, he was trying to soothe people and make sure that they were not overly riled up at a time that the vote in the Congress was happening in 2009 and 10. But unfortunately, it just isn't true. Wasn't then, isn't now. As you said in your setup, practically everything about healthcare needs to change, from who delivers it, to how they are organized together, to how we finance it, to where it's provided, to all those things. We can do much better than we have, but we can't sneak up on the American people. We've got to have this kind of frank conversation with 310 million people and persuade them that it's in their interest long term to change. And that's what we need to be doing.
Well, but how so? I mean, in terms of, you know, let's go sector by sector, and I'll ask you to talk about them.
Sure.
Doctors, hospitals, and then there's the cut: those who have access to care, wealthier people who have access and are paying somewhat, and those who have none. What are the sacrifices each of those sectors are going to have to make?
Physicians, I think what we will see is in a number of the specialties that have been rewarded very greatly economically in recent years, that's going to be brought down. They're going to make less money, if I can put it that way. I believe part of the savings from bringing down the ones at the top is going to be put into bringing up how much is paid to primary care doctors, those at relatively the bottom end of the scale. But we can save money generally in healthcare by savings from what currently goes to physicians. To hospitals, I think we need to do a much better job of value engineering the way we build and operate hospitals. Value engineering is a code word from doing it better but cheaper. I think we've gone way overboard in recent years with how much money we put into the bricks and mortar of hospitals. We don't have to build them that way. We can build perfectly nice hospitals, not as expensively. And hospitals are going to be paid less in the future. Already, right now, we are paid less for our Medicare patients because of the cuts that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has levied to pay for some of the expansions in other places. And then you mention people at the upper end of the scale. What I believe needs to happen is for we ought to pass a law that says if you get health benefits that are actuarially determined to be above a certain level of benefit, then you need to pay tax on those that additional benefit. Currently, fringe benefits, including health fringe benefits, are tax-free to workers like me and you. And that has led over time to richer and richer health benefits for many workers, not all, but for many workers. And I think imposing a cap on the amount that can be received tax-free would, first of all, generate tax revenue for the amount above, but would provide a downward force on keeping health plans and the cost of care more affordable. Ultimately, and I just would make this point, if we're going to be able to expand health coverage to the 50 million or however many have been without full access to health care, the money's got to come from somewhere. And what Obamacare has put in place, but they didn't much want to talk about, is this point, and that is we're going to take things from some people and give it to others. That's an income transfer. And I think we just need to be honest with the American public. If we're going to have a fairer and more equitable system that works better for everybody, that's what we're going to have to do.
So you were once special assistant for health policy to President Ronald Reagan.
Yes, sir.
You never gave him that advice.
I sort of did, or gave it to the people around him. I was not a high-level White House aide in those days. I was a mid-level aide. But, yeah, the things that I'm saying now, I've been saying pretty consistently.
Yeah. Tell me what you did there, and talk about that experience and how experience in a job like that, where you're at the highest levels of government and somehow part of the policymaking apparatus. What do you learn from that, and how do you bring that to the state of North Carolina?
Well, about 30 years ago, 1982-83, I went to Washington, in a wonderful program called the White House Fellows Program. Supposedly was there for a year. My assignment was to work for the president's domestic policy advisor to do health policy work. And it turned into 8 years instead of 1 year, because at least they liked what I produced, and they invited me to stay on as a regular appointee of President Reagan. And then I went over to run the Medicare and Medicaid programs, as you said earlier. You asked, what did I learn from that? I learned that we're a big, complicated country, but that government, when it puts its mind to it, can do important things that benefit a lot of people. But I also learned that governments also can screw things up and is not very nimble and innovative. And so my role as a leader in the organization was to push for change and improvement and push the folks that I was privileged to work with really, really hard.
When you talk about, of course, running Medicare and Medicaid, these two large government programs, and the fear here in this state and elsewhere is, you know, the government can't run anything right. Well, we know they do in Medicare, right. Medicaid, and VA. So what? But there are huge mistakes. What did you learn from that experience? And what could you tell a legislator or a governor about how they could do it right and do it as a government program?
Yeah. Well, I just use an example. When I went in 1986 to head the Medicare and Medicaid programs, I got some advice that I took that was to make a high priority improving the quality of care that was provided in those programs. And so throughout the years that I was there, my stump speech was, we're going to make quality our number one target. We did a whole series of things ranging from publishing statistics on comparing hospitals in the Medicare program for their mortality rates over to improving the way we monitor doctors and hospitals in the program to putting the information generated in Medicare available to researchers and academics to look for better ways to organize and deliver care. And over the ensuing years, I've been pleased to look back on that time and say we made a difference because we put intense focus on a pretty limited set of things and got them done. The lesson that I would draw from that and in answer to your question is it's best to try to do a more limited set of things and to really put one's energy into that instead of trying to get everything done at the same time.
But you address directly the principal challenge to any kind of government program, which is that the government messes it up. And you're saying, well, if we can do accountability, if we do the measures, and if we focus on quality, then at least we have an answer the next time they come back.
That's true. But another point I'd make based on my government time is the vast majority of people who work in government agencies, local, state, federal, are hardworking, well-intentioned, very bright people. And we do them no good and we do ourselves no good if we demean them and criticize them and make fun of them. There are some no accounts and some slackers, and we ought to get rid of them or do something about them. But one of the first things President Bush 41, George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the first things he did, and I worked for him in the White House too, is he, in January of 1989, held an event where he called together thousands of federal workers and said, thank you for what you do on behalf of our country. It's really important to convey that message to the federal workforce in that case.
You also headed CDC.
Yeah.
What do you think? You know, we think of CDC, and maybe the first thing that comes to mind is communicable disease, and those are important. But public health is broader than that, isn't it? And
yeah.
It does include a lot of factors in the environment and social environment that become public health risks.
Yeah, it's really all of the things around us that affect our health as individuals and as communities and as the population. One of the things I'm pleased to recognize these days is the growing interaction between official and voluntary public health organizations and now the healthcare system to recognize that we've all got a stake in making the population healthier.
What would you say is the biggest public health care risk or public health risk in the state of North Carolina?
I'd have to say the obesity epidemic is the number one thing. We are frighteningly overweight as a society and growing more so. Secondly, we still have far too many people who smoke, and that takes a heavy toll on them and on society. And then thirdly, I'd say our very dysfunctional mental health system or non-system leaves thousands of our fellow citizens adrift in a way that is harmful to them and ultimately harmful to us as a society.
I want to talk a little bit about insurance because you joined Prudential Healthcare after CDC. You were president of their Center for Healthcare Research, eventually became senior vice president of Prudential Healthcare. And, of course, whenever we talk about healthcare, we talk about health insurance. That's the one card that was left in the equation. And if you compare us to single payers around the world and you look at our triple cost per capita, 3-to-1 cost, you know, a casual observer might say it's the insurance companies that might be the difference here.
Well, the way I'd answer the question is to say if I were czar for a day or a year and were in charge of that single payer system and could make perfect decisions That'd be a good way to run it. But as you and I were just talking a few minutes ago, government, even on a good day, makes mistakes and is an imperfect system. And I just don't think the American people are going to lodge that much power and responsibility in government, especially now in the wake of this unfortunate screw-up with regard to healthcare.gov's website. So I prefer to talk about the art of the possible and how can we encourage and push insurance companies to play a more constructive role in the process. We're trying to do that here in North Carolina with a partnership we have with Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina to do some innovative things in the delivery of health care. We're excited about that.
And we'll talk more about that as our conversation with Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare and Dean of the UNC School of Medicine, continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Bill Roper, CEO of UNC Healthcare System and Dean of the School of Medicine there. And recently, UNC Healthcare System and Wake Med in Raleigh got into it over their respective roles in that community, a little territorial tiff. Wake Med says one of the charges that Wake Med offered was that they were handling more than their fair share of indigent care than Rex does. And the numbers seem to bear it out.
Well, we've had lots of discussions with them and come to an agreement that we're going to work together in some important areas to improve care in Wake County. As I mentioned just before the break, one of the pressing needs in North Carolina is improvement in mental health services. And one of the commitments we made in our agreement with Wake Med is to invest up to $40 million in improving mental health services. And we've chosen to do that at a facility called Wake Brook that is a place operated initially by Wake County. Now we operate it, and UNC Healthcare operates it, I should say. And what it provides is a place for folks who have mental problems who otherwise would be sitting in somebody's emergency department, either Wake Med's or Rex's or Duke Health Raleigh's, not getting the best of care because an emergency department is not a good place to care for someone who's mentally ill. So we've got a place for people who have the need for a short-term stay or crisis intervention or drug detoxification or other services of that sort. It's been very well received by the medical community there, and I'm happy to say that the various institutions, Wake Med and us and Wake County and the volunteer advocacy community are all being very supportive of this effort. So when we work together, we can do great things.
Expanding the capacity for mental health care is obviously a first step in improving mental health care delivery. But it seems to me we also are in need of some innovative ideas about how to manage it, because not only are you sitting in emergency rooms, but you're possibly sitting in police cars. Yeah. And we're seeing tragically that the police are not properly equipped for this and shouldn't be. And so do we need to, and as a medical school, are you in a good position to do the kind of research to look at different ways to understand mental illness?
Thanks for the question. Yes, we can do better. I'm proud to say that the Department of Psychiatry at UNC is one of the nation's leaders in doing research and then coming up with innovative ways to deliver care better. We need to begin in the public part of this conversation by making the point that the well-intentioned effort that began in the 1960s to, quote, deinstitutionalize the mentally ill was well-intentioned, but it went way overboard because there are a number of people who are mentally ill who need asylum in the best sense of that word. They need protection from the society. And we don't help them by putting them out on the street, and especially we don't help them by putting them on the street without the supporting services to be cared for. And so what simply has to happen, and it's beginning in a bit here in North Carolina. We're proud of the small part we're playing at the Wake Brook facility in Wake County. But what we need to do is restore the opportunity for people to be cared for short-term and even long-term. If I can make one other point, one element of that that we simply have to come to grips with is our legal system doesn't work very well with regard to people who are mentally ill, because we have paid such attention over the last several decades to people's rights and civil rights, and no one can be compelled to be institutionalized against their will, et cetera, that it's almost impossible to confine someone who doesn't want to be and who has not yet harmed themselves or someone else. And I think we need to come up with a better way of dealing with this.
Well, the other complaint and criticism about deinstitutionalization was not only that too many people perhaps were released, but that the money simply didn't follow the patient,
right. Yeah.
And that they weren't getting the proper care that they needed. I think you're talking about finding a way to restore some of that, but now we're seeing actual cuts in mental health services.
Yeah. We have to do better. And it's going to be costing us more. We have underfunded mental health services chronically and to our great detriment. It's a sordid story.
When you see, in terms of health care delivery in the state of North Carolina, what are the biggest challenges facing any system, not only yours?
I think the biggest challenge we face right now is the rapid pace of change, the chaotic environment that we're in. As I typically say to people when I see them on the street and they say the usual, how's it going? Instead of saying fine or I'm busy, these days what I say is it isn't boring. And that's our biggest challenge, because we're trying to anticipate the further change and accommodate to it and get ready, et cetera, while at the same time serving the people who are presenting to our emergency department today and tonight and serving their needs and doing outreach across the state to serve a wider population. Knock on wood, we're doing pretty well right now, but a lot of uncertainties in our environment, and there are not many things that we are confident are going to remain exactly the way they are for the years to come.
Well, the other criticism of the healthcare systems now is that they operate like businesses, but not like businesses, in that many of the incentives are all in the wrong places. For instance, in healthcare delivery, there's really no incentive or no way to measure outcomes. You're paid for the procedure, however it comes out, in a way.
Yeah. I'll tell you a vignette that makes your point. This really happened. When I was head of the Medicare program in the late 80s, in about 1987, surgeons had begun to do heart transplants. And an issue that came to us, the Medicare agency, was when will Medicare start paying for heart transplants? And when does it stop being experimental and become a procedure that Medicare should pay for? And in the cabinet room, I presented to President Reagan and the cabinet our proposal for how Medicare should begin covering the procedure. And the thing that we proposed and that did happen was that it first was paid for in about 20 major centers that had established a program and where care was reasonable and good. But in the discussion that day, one of the members of the cabinet spoke up and said, well, here, I have an idea for you. Why don't you pay for the heart transplant if the patient lives, but not if the patient dies? People laughed, but that's the notion that I think we need to head towards is an incentive for better care and a disincentive for poorer care.
But is there a reasonable way to do that? Is there some way to actually measure those outcomes and reward success? And again, my big fear is, having just suggested that if I'm a doctor being rewarded for good outcomes, I don't want tough cases.
Right. Well, again, you've put your finger on couple of issues there. Yes, there are much better ways today than there were back then what, 25 years ago, to measure and report the quality of care and the outcomes. We're not perfect, but I used to chair the board of an organization called the National Quality Forum that's all about that topic, and we've made real progress. And now Medicare is paying incrementally more for good performance and incrementally less for poorer performance. But one of the dangers, as you highlight, is we don't want to put incentives before people to deny entry into the system of people who are likely to have bad outcomes. Otherwise, they will have no place to go.
It does seem, though, that you can certainly weight certain kinds of cases.
Severity adjustment, as it's called, it can be done, not perfectly, but we're getting better at it.
And the other kind of malfunction in the market system is the way insurance companies work, in that they compete to get a share of the market. So what they're doing is trying to line up as many employers as possible. They're their clients. I want good medical care, but I don't deal directly with the provider. Right. I've got an insurance company that signed up with my employer. So that sort of defeats the mechanism, and it allows enormous market share. I mean, here in North Carolina, you know, Blue Cross and Blue Shield has a near monopoly. I'm not saying anything is necessarily going wrong, but in principle, is that a good thing?
Well, it's a good thing to have competition, and I think we are better if people know that there are alternatives available. I think a part of the insurance process that we would be better if we had was individuals having a stake in the cost of care ourselves. I know, as a recipient of medical care and a person covered with health insurance, I love having first dollar coverage and no copays, no deductibles. But what that produces in me, I know, is an overuse of medical care services, probably incrementally beyond what I really need. And so I believe that we are better off if we have a system that where it costs me something, and it needs to be a sliding scale of what it costs me based on my ability to pay. But I need to feel some pain.
Well, but everybody does, right? I mean, there are always copays and deductibles, aren't there?
There are some. Not every health insurance plan has meaningful deductibles. So, yeah.
But in terms of the market share and in some cases near monopoly control, this certainly allows insurance companies to dictate the prices they're going to pay, and then that has an influence on the kind of care that you get and whether or not I'm going to provide this service or that because, you know, on the list, this one pays more. This is a kind of funny way to do medical care, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is the system that we've evolved to, and we've just gone through an enormous public debate, and looks like we're not going to change that system. So,
you have in your life as a pediatric doctor, as a pediatrician, stressed preventive care.
Yeah.
In your practice, nationally, I mean, are we paying enough attention to that? Because that's another way you can really bring down costs.
Well. I think we're doing some better, but as I said a moment ago, we still have far too many people who don't eat right and who don't exercise enough and are therefore overweight or obese. We have way too many people who smoke, who don't make wise decisions as far as their sexual practices, and on and on and on. We could do better as far as educating people. I'm a real believer, though, in, again, providing economic incentives. So the notion of I ought to bear a heavier copay or cost of health insurance if I smoke or am overweight, I think that'd be a good idea. Now, some people say that's blaming the victim and so on. So there needs to be some reasonable boundaries around what I'm describing. But I think it would be taking us in the right direction.
So you talked about the instinct to grow if you're an insurance company and to gain market share. But UNC Healthcare has been criticized for its rapid growth and the amount of growth. Is there – what's behind that?
Sure.
Do you need to grow to survive?
what lies behind it essentially is health care in America, especially or including here in North Carolina, is consolidating. Doctors and hospitals are choosing to come together into larger organizations. We didn't start that process. It's caused in particular because of the very complexity of health insurance and the needs for sophisticated information technology and management skill and so on. So the challenge for us as an organization, as that is happening around us, is will we participate in that consolidation? Or will we take ourselves out of the game and sit on the sidelines while others do it around us? And obviously the choice that we and the board that I report to have made is we're going to be participants in it. That doesn't mean we're going to buy every hospital or doctor practice. We only go into the communities that invite us in, and we've not won every one of these deals that's been put up for bid. But we have grown, and I think we've grown responsibly, but we'll see.
You talked about your job not being boring in these days, in the immediate aftermath of the Affordable Care Act and its going into effect. Are things beginning to settle down, or are you still seeing?
No, we're still in the takeoff stage of chaos right now. And I think that's the new normal, if I can put it that way. We're a long way from being able to settle down to normalcy.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, Bill Roper. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, sir.
Bill Roper is CEO of UNC Healthcare System. It includes Rex Hospital in Raleigh. He is also the dean of the UNC School of Medicine. You can get more information at our website, stateofthings.org, and that's our program for today. State of Things is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.